Welcome to Not the Limitless, the podcast between, but between the podcast between. There's a couple of conversations that I had last year that I'm sharing as a liminal limitless. I have a thing about this podcast that I like to maintain, which is one is consecutive, so that you listen to them in the order that these conversations happened, and the other is as fresh as possible. And well, I made a new departure with the podcast, focusing on Rudolf Steiner, and in the meantime, these audios, I didn't have access to them, so they got back long, and now I don't want to just include them as part of the Limitless sequence, so I'm just going to provide them, make them available to you in the interim, in between the sequential unfolding of this Limitless exploration. This is the first of two, with Heidi Crame. Also, the other element here is that the audio quality at Heidi's end is not terribly good, so you may find rather difficult to hear some of what she's saying. But it was an interesting conversation, and definitely was too good just to leave on my hard drive. So without further ado, this is me and Heidi Kramer. Because if I told you, I'd probably burn the day.
Well, I have to say your book is magnificent. I've really, really enjoyed reading it.
Thank you. Did you make it all the way through? It seems you
started. Well, I had to sort of skim pages, 420 to 460. So as soon as we're done, I'm going to go back. I mean, I was up all night. Let's just find my eyes are bloodshot. Because it's that fabulous. Couldn't put it down, you know. So,
like with a torch under the sheets, so
pretty much,
your mom
yeah.
and dad wouldn't catch
Actually,
you.
Even funnier with my computer. You know, I'm so used to a book.
Yeah.
So I had my computer on its side, so that I could lie down and read. You know.
If I'd known, I'd have tried to get you a copy, although.
Yeah. I know, it's okay. I have to adapt to these things, you know.
I suppose. I don't want to adapt to reading books online because I don't. To me, a book is, I want to be in bed or very comfortable and without having my face radiated.
Yeah.
But anyway, thank you for digging so much in there.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Well, that's not an adjective I expect to hear too often. In the reviews.
Well, it's it was I guess kind of like my book, it's it's a tough read because it's so, I'm gonna say real, but it's a deep read
and somewhat bleak.
The
prognosis isn't very good.
Yeah.
For culture, certainly, but even for humankind that has been bred on this culture and weaned on it and seems to be addicted to it. So let's start with the obvious parallels between your work and mine, which you can introduce and name. Which is the promotion of cruelty, the prevalence of cruelty in the media. Mm-hmm. So maybe let's start there, and if we could just sum up a little bit your work and the thesis, that would be good for the listeners, I think.
So I started, I did a thesis on the education system and how that was changed during the progressive era. And that still affects us today. And then...
Sorry, you were a bit muffled there. Maybe we were mumbling a bit. The prevalence of what?
I was studying the education system.
Yeah.
And how that was changed during the progressive era.
Right.
And then, and it still affects us today. And then I just happened to see Monsters Incorporated, and I was really drawn into the image of Boo strapped in the scream extractor, which is essentially a torture chair. And I started noticing other images like that, and I decided to write this book, Media Monsters, Militarism, Violence, and Cruelty in Children's Culture. And so the work is sort of example after example. I mean, I break it into, you know, TV and do sort of a big analysis on a lot of the kids' films and video games and so forth. But it's kind of just a bunch of examples of what I have come to think of as really destructive and not just pedagogical in a how one's supposed to live one's life sort of a way, but also, you know, just what are the implications of growing up with those messages. So, yeah.
Did you see Monster Incorporated with a child then?
I did. It was with my son, and it came out in, I think, 2001, so he was, you know, 5 or 6, I guess. And we, you know, we ingested all of this media. You know, I thought I was being the good mom, you know, when he was born, and I, you know, went out and got all the Disney classics that I had enjoyed. And then, but as an adult, watching them again, I mean, I was pretty appalled. But worse, in 2001, there seemed to be a shift where, I mean, down to the point where if friends of mine had seen a movie with their kids before I had a chance to see it, I would say, is there the obligatory torture scene? And they would go, no. And then they'd go, oh, wait, you know,
right.
Because there's the happy music and, you know, the good ending. And by the end, you're distracted from it. But yeah, when you go back and really look at it, you know. And so I started collecting the images, the stills of the films, which I hope to make into a little sort of short film. And that's where I think you really see it. You know, you see Mr. Incredible, you know, strangling Mirage, and you see, you know, just most horrible images that are specifically made, right? I mean, every line in those films is, you know, that there's a purpose to it, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't know the effects of, as hard as this media can be on us, and as you know, trying to purge yourself of something that's negative, what is it when their whole world is that? And, you know, people have said to me, oh, but, you know, the fairy tales weren't a good time. And I'm like, well, no, but they were told by community elders or by family, and it was, people were telling this story, and they were filled with messages, right? Like, don't go out into the world alone or whatever, you know, be cautious or whatever. And now it's, you know, either a big screen or now, especially, you know, the kids are just sitting a few feet away from it, right in front of them over and over again. They're watching these films. I went to like a preschool one time with a friend to pick up their granddaughter, and you know, they had these films playing in every room, and the kids were just sitting there. There's a great film, short film called Evidence, and it's what's the name of the director? Did the Kanastasi series, and it's it's just the camera going back and forth, watching the expressions on these little kids' faces. And I think they're watching Pinocchio, I think. And it's almost like watching, it's like watching, if you can imagine an alien coming to this planet and just being confused, you know, like, it's like they want to laugh, but they're just clearly sort of in a stupor, horrified, you know. It's quite a, it really sort of sums it up, I think.
That's interesting. Is it, did you say the name of the film is Evidence?
Yeah, I think that's the name of it. And I'm trying to remember the name of the director. It's really a great series. The first one in the series is Tom Stasky, which is because it's images of, I can't remember the breakdown now.
Did you say Stanislavski?
No, it's Kayana Scotsky, and it's a, and I may not be saying pronouncing it correctly, but it's a an indigenous term I think he uses for all the films, and it's images of, you know, like, I just remember this one scene of this little kid walking down a dusty street in this vehicle that's, you know, 10 times the size or something is going by. It's clearly some sort of mining operation or something, and so it's just images with music. They're quite brilliant. I'll think of a director.
Often I notice interesting convergences or parallels with people I speak to, and sometimes it's right away, and in this case it is, because I went to see it when it came out in 2001 with my niece, who is 20, just turning 24, so she would have been 4 or 5 at that time, probably four, so almost a dead match. Did you enjoy the movie, and did your son enjoy it at the time, would you say?
Well, I distinctly remember looking over at him with that scene when she's in that chair, and we both had our mouths open, like in shock. When I went back and looked at the film more thoroughly, you know, there's even outside of the torture room, there's tools that are commonly used for torture, you know, hanging on the wall. I mean, there were so many things in that film. When the guy, I can't remember the character's name, is, you know, thrown on the ground. I mean, there's so much 9/11 imagery, right? There's the rappelling down the ropes, and, you know, they break into the company, and, you know, the whole city. Like, I think at that point, the only thing that we had seen that was that violent, I guess, was the Brave Little Toaster series. And that went right to video. And one of the films in that series has the, you know, just filled with horror tropes, you know. And one of the characters, the air conditioner gets so upset he just blows up, you know. Which was quite shocking. But the realism that Pixar uses, I mean, yeah, we were stunned. I don't know, how was your niece?
Well, we both enjoyed it a lot. I haven't seen it since then, and more than just enjoying it for me was, and this was a period in my life that I've written about, my being the one period. So what I now look back as a kind of full blown delusional period of my life. Although, you know, it had its good points too. It was very creative and quite inspired, but it was also pretty demented in its way. Anyway, and I so identify with the movie The Matrix, I write about it in 16 Maps, that I took on the mythology and try, you know, sort of try to embody it and create my own semi-fictional narrative and movie around it and wrote Matrix Warrior. So all this was coincided with Monsters in Court. That was the period that I watched it with my niece at the cinema, which was one of my uncle, I wouldn't say duties, pleasures really, but I would, you know, as her uncle, I would take her to the movies sometimes. And the parallels between Monsters Incorporated and The Matrix were striking, because it's about, you know, it's the feeding on the fears of children, isn't it? Monsters who feed on the fears of children, and this whole industry that's around it, which is like The Matrix. And this corresponds, I don't know how familiar you would be, with various esoteric doctrines. Coincidentally enough, that Dave O'Shaughnessy, who I'm participating in his project currently, he's currently talking about this, these ancient parasites that feed on our energies and our emotions, whatever they are. He's not saying what they are, but hungry ghosts is one of the terms in Eastern spiritual tradition. And so anyway, the point being that I found the film very meaningful, as well as entertaining. So back then, back in that context, even though I didn't think I was naive at all, and I would have acknowledged, yes, this is a big, you know, Pixar Hollywood movie, so it's going to have its subliminals and there's going to be some dark side to it, I still saw it as an unusually good film, and that it had a positive message, or at least in the sense that it was revealing something important through the narrative, like a fairy tale, about the nature of society. So, I mean, this, I just think it's an interesting point to start our conversation with, because, and I don't get into this in 16 Maps of Hell, as you know, I don't get into the subliminal imagery and this kind of thing. And I don't analyze films frame by frame, or even generally for their content. I'm looking more at the industry and the makers and the ideologies that are running through it. But I have, of course, been aware of the subliminal manipulation of imagery, particularly in Disney movies, for a long time. And I'm not skeptical about it. But I still feel like I could be devil's advocate here in a way, in that maybe there's two things going on here. And one is that you're zeroing in on, and that is what we're going to talk about today. But our direct experience, most of us, is that we enjoy these movies. And this is true even today, because I do still watch movies and TV shows. Admittedly, I've refined my discernment. I've developed more and more discernment, I think. So I'm more and more adverse to overt propaganda, including what you point out, the torture scenes. Like any TV show, once the torture comes in, usually I turn it off if I've even made it that far. Because, well, it's not just that it's a torture scene. They do tend to be very obvious delivery devices for an ideological rationalization and so on, right? In Monsters Incorporated, I didn't even notice it. I'd have to go back and watch it. Because the context was so, I'd say it was a rich and deep context, this mythological, mythopoetic narrative. So does that make it even more insidious and pernicious, or does that partly redeem it? That's one of the questions I wrestle with.
Well, you know, to my mind, I guess I find it sort of annoying now, actually, when something is so good otherwise, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, great film for adults, but what are the concepts being introduced to children, right? I mean, you're putting yourself in Boo's shoe, you know. Again, these things are, especially with Pixar's use of computers, you know, they're terribly realistic. So you're putting yourself in this little girl's shoes, and then you basically are seeing yourself, right, in that chair, or being scared. I mean, given a larger context of child abuse, Right. I mean, to me, like the ramifications, it almost makes it now like, you know, great film for adults, right? But it makes it, I don't know how to say it other than tainted, because otherwise there's this really incredible, like, I mean, I love these films, right? I mean, I have a bit of a hard time watching them now, but I mean, at the time we were there, geez, you know, every other weekend or something, you know, seeing one of these films. And I've been frustrated that it like ruins the overall experience. Now, you know, it's not that I'm anti-violent particularly. I mean, you know, when Defiance came out, my son was, I don't know, but, you know, early teens, I guess, maybe, or something. And that's one of the goriest movies I've ever seen. But it's about during the Holocaust, you know, a man who like rescued a town worth of people by taking them into the woods and hiding them. But to my mind, that's not gratuitous violence, right? Like, that's a real story. That's an important thing to know about, you know. But to see, I guess also to see that shift, that it coincided with 9/11. So it's not that you can't look back, right? Like, I'm, you know, still traumatized by, well, I don't know, Snow White, you know, or something, you know, and the apple, or the Willy Wonka, right? That scene where they're going through the tunnel and the images that flash, right? Or like, I think one of them is like a chicken getting its head cut off or something. These terrible images. You know, why is that in there? You know, it, particularly that one, because it's not clear what's happening. It's just, there's a melange very, very quickly. So I guess, you know, like somebody said to me once, you know, if you're looking for something, you'll find it. And I was like, well, that's not really the case, because when I watch like certain Miyazaki films, Hayao Miyazaki, the great Japanese artist, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but his G-rated films are actually G-rated films, right? Like, they're not adding the violence into those ratings. So I feel sort of duped, you know, like that I brought my son to these things, not really recognizing how, you know, 90% of it would be great, but then there was this other part that was soul destroying, or making somebody primed for abuse, I guess, right? Because, you know, in a larger context, to sit there and you know, laugh along with it with a child next to you is sort of saying that you're complicit in it, I guess, you know.
Yeah. That interesting, if that came up on the last day of a Shana event too, that he was talking about Charlie Chaplin and how millions of people who love Charlie Chaplin, the oppressed working class, generally speaking, would laugh at a guy falling on a banana peel, which at its core is sadism, really, is laughing at somebody's pain, enjoying somebody's pain, which is the definition of sadism. And even though it's, that could seem, without the context, and hopefully we're creating the context here today, just as Dave was creating the context for when he said it, that would just seem reactionary and absurd, and just so, you know, such a disproportionate reaction and just totally misrepresenting, right? But there really is this massive underbelly of repressed rage, pain, abuse, fear, exploitation, in the case of Chaplin, but also in the case of Monsters Incorporated, that you actually can't divorce the humor or the enjoyment or the pleasure that the violence or the pain is causing in the audience. You actually can't divorce it from the deeper context.
Well, and I think we all have a tendency, right? You see it. But again, because everything works out okay in the film, right? You sort of suppress it, right? Well, that was a bad thing that happened, but then, right? I mean, like, just even in creating these works of art and stuff. I mean, something has to happen, right?
Well, that's right. Yeah, bad things have to happen, sure, of course.
You know, but then, you know, it's not just like, I mean, this is all the films, you know, so there's an accumulation
of
similar events happening, and that's the part that, I don't know.
Two things I wanted to say, probably won't be able to say them at the same time, but one is on this, continuing on this point, and this is what 16 Maps of Hell tries to show, is that these products are coming out of a culture of abuse, where abuse is endemic. And so the people who make these movies, and Disney, I mean, as I explore a little bit in the book, certainly there are close connections, let's say, or lots of evidence that the Disney circle incorporates actual child predators in it. I won't go into examples. But so that suggests that the people who are creating these images, they have an affinity for that, even if they're not actually consciously complicit with it or actually doing it. So that would suggest that the way that the imagery and the way that it's actually being presented, it is corrupt. It's not empathic, right? And that's going to be the key, isn't it? Essentially, the medium is the message, and again, the context. What's the actual flavor of this? Is it generating compassion, empathy, and thereby helping children to reconcile themselves to a difficult world, to adverse circumstances and so on, which is what fairy tales were supposed to be about, maybe a little bit cathartic or maybe very cathartic and so on? Or is it just, as you're suggesting, putting in these programs, exploiting the fears of the children? And this is the other point I wanted to make, where there's a very interesting passage from Pauline Kael, the film critic, about Dumbo and how appalled she was by Dumbo when she saw it, because of how it preys upon the child's deepest fears, like the Dumbos are separated from her mother, and these series of events that are designed to manipulate children by exploiting their worst fears, thereby generating the emotional response and the investment that they will get swept away by the fantasy. And of course, Dumbo is seen as totally benign, but certainly relatively benign. But that took a particularly discerning eye just to recognize something that's, I think, become so endemic in our culture as normal. And this is what entertainment is, that we've had our faculties for recognizing it just deadened, I think.
I think so too, and I think that desensitization is a dangerous thing, but also just as opposed to a gentle guiding of the world can be tough. It's what you said about Hitchcock, right? Like, the only problem is we're not torturing women enough, kind of thing, right? Or just having that in your mind that it's a thrill to throw people's consciousness. So you can replace the word woman with child, right? Like, not abusing the children enough, kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
So you're opening up the world of, these extraordinary, awful things can happen to me. I mean, in the Dumbo case, right, like that's your greatest fear, right? As a child who's being ripped away from your parents, right? That would be earth shattering, right? For children under 7 years old, they have a difficult time. It's like somebody who's tripping their brains, right? Like little kids just sort of running around, right? Like they have a difficult, like they're not capable at that age of differentiating between reality and, images that are in front of them, right? So that's problematic. I started bringing my son to films when he was 2 or 3 years old, because of the rating, I assumed that, they would be nice films, but I was not. And I think, like, so what does that say about where our society is headed if there really is that divide in 2001, right, of, just a war ethic across the board, right? Whether it's Marvel characters or it's something that's supposed to be G-rated. It's a nationalistic really way of, that's probably the greatest military export that we have.
The greatest what, sorry?
Military export that we have is these films, really. Right, because you're transporting an ideology of, of course we're seeing the effects of that, not just that whoever has the biggest punch wins, whether there's control with violence, right, but also just a rich white male Christian perspective that's some of these films, the split is 50-50 between sales in the US and sales overseas, so it's exporting ideology. And what are we saying? Like, you know, somebody gets one in another country for their little kid, and the messages might make Sprite. You know, that's pretty harsh. That wouldn't be my number one choice of things to export.
Yeah, I think it's, or at least it was, back when I read that stat, that it was movies which were second to Arms in terms of the greatest export business for the US. And as you're pointing out, they support each other. And of course, now we've even got these movies that more and more that are, if not funded by the military, they're supported by it, or the military cooperates and provides the weapons and the helicopters and all the rest of it, because they're promoting military action. And certainly, I mean, that's a fairly simple, straightforward, big picture analysis or description of Hollywood that maybe isn't even that controversial nowadays, that Hollywood is to some degree, if not primarily, if not almost entirely, the propaganda arm of the military industrial complex. I speculate in 60 Maps of Hell that it was even created with that end in mind. I mean, Disney certainly, as I point out, had the cooperation of the military back in the 40s, and were making movies for the war effort. So it goes back at least as far as the 40s, but I mean, I just think it's just common sense to presume that it goes all the way back to its inception.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this seems like another example of something that's somehow hidden in plain sight, and that we've kind of unconsciously been conditioned to become complicit with, to the point that it's very hard to see it, even though it's irrefutable. And undeniable. The question I have, and I'll make it a question for you, but it's a question I have for myself constantly, is how does it work? Because in some cases it's obvious, you know, if a movie involves needs the cooperation of the US military and the military, and then they say you need to change the script here and there in order to get the cooperation, that's obvious. But that wouldn't be the case with Monsters Incorporated, for example, because it's all Pixar. So do you speculate, or do you just wonder about how hands-on this manipulation of the product is in terms of micromanaging the content, are the military personnel working in Hollywood undercover, or is it a subtler kind of coercion at work?
Well, I mean, one assumes, I guess, that there would be a range. I like to assume that it would be, you know, different depending on the feature, you know, or the company, you know, production company, and so forth. But
yeah. But
I have to say, I feel like I'd be very, very surprised whether, knowingly or not, there wasn't, you know, a weapons expert, for instance, you know, in the midst of this. And whether it's by design or not, right, the end result is the same. But, and also, you know, in fairness to us, right, like, I mean, you and I have that in common, right? Like, I did a good bit of acting. I was interested in filmmaking. These things are part of us because it's our culture, right? Like, it's the reference of our good times, right? Like, you bringing your niece, or my bringing my son, right? It's you know, it's like getting rid of food or something, right? So, and we've been, you know, we've gotten used to greater amounts, right? Like, you know, it's like a drug or something, right? Like, whatever it is, sex or violence or, you know, whatever it is, right? Like, so I feel like it's not really our, like, I remember trying to find, you know, there's a video game category EC for early childhood. Well, good luck finding one of those at the store. I mean, unless it's changed.
What's it called? Sorry, the category?
It's EC for early childhood. I mean, but, you know, like maybe there's one out of, you know, like 100 or something, you know, when you go to buy them, or at least at the time.
What's a weird coincidence there, because EC comics were those horrific horror comics that I...
Oh, that's a riot. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, and if I remember right, it's like a little E and a big C, which always sounds kind of odd. So I don't feel like we can blame ourselves, you know? I mean, we're... But it's just... I feel like, you know, when you stop and look at it, I feel like it is that nationalistic, it is that, you know, hard line. I mean, what kind of person, you know, yeah, it'd be cool if you said, oh, and let's also have torture tools hanging on the wall, right, in like a film made for adults, but for something that's specifically designed, that's not supposed to have anything that, you know, disturbing or something, you know, in it for kids, it really makes me wonder. I mean, about, like, I just, you know, shows like Homeland and 24 were created specifically to get the American people on board with torture and being okay with it, you know, and I feel like that's what they're doing here. You know,
in subtler ways, because it's for a younger audience, so it can work at a subtle level. And presumably, I mean, as far as I know, these movies, even when they're overtly a bit scary, which The Incredibles isn't, I mean, I guess that's the spectrum. I mean, they got to create suspense and adrenaline, otherwise they wouldn't be exciting. So maybe I'll take that back, because an exciting movie for kids probably is always scary in some way, but even when it's not overtly dark, let's say, which they're probably generally not, and because Monsters Incorporated, the monsters aren't even that particularly horrific. It seems as though the horrific imagery is more subtly installed. Most kids don't have nightmares as a result of these movies, which would be a tell, wouldn't it? Like, if parents were taking their kids to these movies and their kids were having nightmares, they would start to wonder. So presumably there's been an attempt to incept these values and these images and these sympathies, if I use that term, in a way that's subtle enough that the child and the adult feels happy and that they're getting good product, and that you know, they don't maybe think that these movies are going to help their children develop good values. I don't know who would be that naive, but they're naive enough to at least think that there's not going to be any negative side effects, because there's nothing observable, right, unless one looks very closely.
Well, there's certain things, right? Like, there was, I forget who it was now, if it was the American Academy of Pediatrics, I'm not sure, that violence, it's not good to expose children to violence, whether it's in front of them, you know, in real life,
yeah,
or it's on a screen, right? And what's particularly bad is when it's a good character, right? somebody that's
yeah.
friends, you know, that is acting like that, or when there's no you know, taking responsibility for an action. So like in the Toy Story series, you know, it's Buzz, who we've gotten to know over two movies, who's our friend, who, you know, turns on his friends and starts beating the crap out of them, you know, and is, you know, second man to the overlord, you know. And that's full of, you know, it's a very dystopian film of, I mean, there's the scene that I forget, it's a minute or two long, of all the toys are going off to the incinerator, you know, that really it's, you know, so it's like prison and concentration camp sort of themes in that film. I mean, so who knows how many nightmares there are. I mean, I say in my book, you know, that a friend of mine started having these like terribly violent dreams, you know, and you know, a grown woman, you know, and I was like, so are you watching something weird? And she said, no, but I am playing a lot of video games. And she's having these nightmares that, you know. So
it's interesting. I just remembered something for myself, that when I did jigsaw puzzles, fairly recently in my 40s, I started doing jigsaw puzzles a lot. I would dream about doing jigsaw puzzles. So it occurs to me, and I noticed that because it was unusual, but if one were to dream about imagery from movies and TV, one wouldn't notice it because it would just be consistent with ordinary dream imagery.
I think we're much more we're all a bit like sponges. You know, once you see something, you can't unsee it.
A bit like what, sorry?
Sponges.
Sponges, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. I was going to use the word impressionable. We're much more impressionable than we realize.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, this, the idea that violence would be harmful to children and even adults, even simulated violence, as you say, there's plenty of data for it, and it's actually common sense if one thinks about it, at least if one thinks deeply enough about it. But it's also an idea that many people feel has been disproven, I think. Discredited, and there's a general consensus of poo-pooing that, which is not Christian. Actually, Christians are probably the only group to this day who are still saying, "No, this stuff is harmful." So it's actually it's a different mindset that's dominant. And I just mentioned that because you mentioned Christian in terms of the ideology of movies, and I don't think it is Christian. At all.
Not true Christian.
No, I mean, it pays lip service because they want to market it, they want to appeal to a wider audience. But I don't know what we'd call that, but the progressive mindset has, and because I grew up in that, and I grew up with the conviction that violence was not harmful, violence in movies, and that anyone who thought it was a stupid Christian prude like Mary Whitehouse. And we had just scorn for this person. And I think that's, you know, I think it's carried through. Like it's won the battle for many people cognitively. They just don't believe, they reject the idea, I think, that violence, that, and of course, well, the proof is in the pudding, because if they didn't, they wouldn't be consuming all this stuff. Like endlessly.
Well, and again, like the early childhood video games, like, you really have to make an effort to find something else.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's mostly what's out there, you know? And I think we have a tendency to go, no, no, it's fine. Because to really look at it, it's too painful. It's like child abuse, you know? Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like, you know, why are there so many, you know, satanic, for lack of a better word, I like that word, but you know, images in Disney bag, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, really, the average person doesn't really have the time to, you know, to hunt for things. But I did want to say this other thing. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with George Gerbner and his theory on mean world syndrome. He has this theory that the more meanness that you see, the more it has an effect, not only of, you know, desensitizing you after, you know, scaring crap out of you, whatever, but it also makes a person only want to hang out with people like them, which, you know, is a little dangerous in a world where we really need to be coming together. I mean, you know, maybe not physically these days, you know what I mean? But the more we can be compassionate and understanding and you know, it's really an interference.
So he's saying that. Or is he saying that the more people are exposed to meanness, including just simulations or fictional, the more they distrust difference. Yeah.
Yeah, what's the scary ramifications?
Well, that would increase meanness as well, I think, wouldn't it? Because it would increase reactivity, fear, suspicion, hostility, and yeah. Well, I mean, it's kind of revelatory in a way, because, I mean, not that so much, but the whole thing we're talking about, that, I mean, it occurred to me, again, very obvious, you don't have to, you can go way further back than Hanna-Barbera, because, I mean, than Pixar, because Hanna-Barbera, I mean, I grew up on Tom and Jerry, it's all violence.
It is. I mean, I think the difference now, in addition to these, in addition to, you know, I mean, that was the argument, right? Sort of, I guess, when we were growing up, was, you know, is it bad for kids to see, you know, Tom and Jerry club each other over the head or whatever, and then in the next scene they're fine. So you're not learning that that can be harmful, you know, be careful, whatever, right?
Yeah.
But now, I mean, that seems so simple now to me compared to, you know, Mr. Incredible strangling this woman. And it's terribly realistic. I mean, you know, and we spend all day going, oh, but the art. Well, yeah, it's amazing art, right? It always is, you know. I do an analysis of The Big Bang Theory because it's such a popular show here. It was at the time. And, you know, one laugh after another, and you laugh because you think they're supposed to, you know, the parts of it, right? But then they would like stick something in that was completely inappropriate and shocking, you know. And often, you know, harmful or militaristic. You know, just for me, now it just sort of blows the whole thing, you know. I mean, because I've seen, you know, it was one thing when they were doing it in material for adults, you know, and that, you know, that's upsetting enough, I guess, you know, but that it's for little minds, you know, that are still developing, that's, to me,
Well,
it's criminal, you know.
back when I wrote The Blood Poets, which you may or may not know, is my first book, and it was a celebration of movie
violence. I need to read your other works. This one really, you're a much better scholar than I'll ever be.
Oh, well, I don't know. I don't really even aspire to being a scholar. I gate crashed academia, definitely.
Those are always the best ones, you know.
All right. Well, thank you.
I played along, but I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah. No, I couldn't play along. I couldn't even finish, you know, what you call high school. But Blood Poets, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it per se. I think I've cannibalized it in a way that person wouldn't really need to go back to the original unless you love movies, right? Because that was the place it was written from, and specifically violence in movies. Anyway, one of the things I wrote in there was that although I don't believe that the world would be a better place if we didn't have these kind of the nasty kind of violent movies, as in what's called torture porn now, even just, you know, horror movies or somewhere on the spectrum closer to what even then I would acknowledge as not healthy movies. I was saying, although I don't think the world would be a better place without these kind of movies, it does beg the question, what kind of a world is it that we turn to this as entertainment? Mm. And that's where I'm still at, really. That's why it was partly how I'm still able to rationalize not having given this stuff up, because I'm not convinced that just stopping watching it is what I need, as opposed to really healing the thing in myself that makes me want to watch it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there is a cold turkey thing. I mean, it probably would be good for me in many ways to give this stuff up cold, but there are other ways maybe it wouldn't, because it's a big way for me to relax. I try not to watch violent stuff much these days, but I think it's all insidious in its way. So my approach still to this day is more, well, can we follow it back, you know, follow the media and our own fascination for it back to what it is in us that is generating this media and consuming it. And that brings back to the Hanna-Barbera again, thinking like, well, and what your friend was saying, well, if you look for it, you'll find it. Well, I mean, if that's true, and you're pointing out it's not really true, because they're not all equal, not all media is created equal, but even to the extent it is true, that leaves unasked the question, well, why? You're not imagining it, you're finding it because it's so prevalent. And she's just not finding it because she's not looking, is the counterpoint. And the question is, you know, why is it that, for example, we can't even imagine entertaining cartoons without cats hitting mice with a frying pan? It's the other way around, isn't it? Mice hitting Jerry with a frying pan, that somehow that's the only kind of humor, you know, as if we took out the violence, there wouldn't, but actually it's so narrow, isn't it?
I mean, I think part of it is, I think part of it is that it's just easy to do, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and as a filmmaker, whether it's animated or not, you know, it is a way to, you know, excite the crowd, right? Like, and negative things tend to influence us more than positive things, right? So, you know, it's like, it's like relying on jokes about a particular type of person, right? Or, you know, a particular race or something, you know. But also, you know, in the US, right, like from its inception, right, like the entertainment, once it went from small towns and started to, you know, form, I guess, I don't know, like bigger, you know, it was like, then it was like brought into the cities, and then now it's just this corporate, you know, mess or whatever. But once that shift happened, you know, it went from sort of dancing around the maypole to something that is quite violent. I mean, I remember seeing, and I cannot remember the name of this film, but it was a black and white film about gangsters. And it was one of the ones that they did at the time to stop people from being gangsters. So it was like,
yeah,
government, you know,
right.
Most of it is. And it was terrifying. It was this black and white movie, and you know, these, you know, thugs killed this guy, and they like bring the body back to his house and like lean him up, you know, he's dead, and then they like lean him up against the door and like ring the doorbell and leave. So when like his family opens the door, you know, he closes. Mm-hmm. That's one of the most terrifying things I've ever seen, you know. But so I think part of it is sort of a Three Stooges kind of thing, right? Like, oh, that's a way to, you know, get the crowd going or something, you know. But two things I was going to say is, one is, I can't remember his first name, but Adorno is the last name.
Theodore,
thank you. Hmm. And he said something to the effect of, what we do for work becomes our entertainment.
Hmm.
This is kind of an interesting way to look at it too, right? Like, as society gets more violent, I mean, the other thing is Dr. Amy Russ, who's in the American Studies and Humanities Department at University of South Florida, said to me when I started writing the thesis on torture in three Pixar films, she said, notice when you're watching this whose perspective it's from. Hmm. So are you made to feel like the torturer or the torturee?
Hmm.
And in most cases, it is the torturee.
Hmm.
So that's kind of an interesting thing. You know, what is that doing to us psychologically, especially if it's five or something like that?
That's probably different for adult material, isn't it? Because certainly horror films, you're almost always in the point of view of the killer, I think.
Oh, that's interesting. I haven't seen very many of them. I did see a very funny one that did startle me at this particular point, called Baghead, I think is the name of it.
Oh, yeah, that was Mark Duplass. That was just a really quirky thing.
Yeah, that was a good little...
But also with the 24 and these torture things, usually the person being tortured is the criminal, and they have to, right? The good guy's usually doing the tortures.
Mm-hmm.
So you would be identified with the torturer in those adult movies. So.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that's another shift too, isn't it? You know, like, there came a point where they were talking about how, you know, women were finally being portrayed as stronger, and I was like, people are being portrayed as stronger, they're being portrayed as meaner, like, yeah. Finally they're, you know, and there was a teenage movie, I guess, I want to say it was called Kick-Ass, and if I remember right, the girl playing the part is supposed to be, you know, one of the good guys or whatever. Yeah, if I remember it, she did something horrible, like, without needing to, like, cuts off somebody's hand or something, and I was like, so I think it's really an indication of how, like, really messed up our society is, or at least the people who, you know, yearn to play with the audience in a mean-spirited way, right? Like, you could if you were really a good filmmaker, you know, delight without all those things. You could deeply inspire people, you know. But why is it that they've chosen not to? And by the way, can I just say, listening here on a personal level, I don't think that we should feel badly for being you know, for wanting to be entertained by these things. I mean, I still, you know, the other day, embarrassingly on Amazon, because I do think they're evil. And so,
who's evil? Sorry,
Amazon.
Oh, Amazon, yeah.
But you know, I was on Prime, and you know, it was free, right? So, you know, and that's how they hook you, you know, of course, right? So, it's Netflix or whoever it is, right? So then you're on there and you're finding other stuff, you know, like the lead in of the store, sailors, and the leader of the film. But anyway, and I watched this beautiful film called The House by the Sea, which was a French film. And as I was watching it, and it wasn't that there weren't sad moments, and there weren't, but it was appropriate to the piece, you know. It wasn't how much, you know, abuse or whatever can we cram into this thing, you know, whatever. And I thought, you know, I wish there were more films like this, you know, because you know, it seems like it's, you know, maybe one in every 20 that I try to put on, you know, that's really worthwhile. And I think about it for days and I'm inspired by it, you know, and it gives me a different perspective. Yeah.
Coming back to what we were touching on there, you know, why so much of this imagery is violent and how that's the shortest route to entertainment or to stimulating the audience. There's an idea, I don't know how true it is, that all pleasure is relief. I don't know if you've heard that idea, but the examples used, like, you know, it's pleasurable to drink cool water because it's relief from thirst. It's pleasurable to eat a good meal because it's relief from hunger. It's pleasurable to have sex because it's relief from, well, maybe the pressure of semen if you're a guy, but even if you're a woman, just it can be a relief from just the stresses of life. So I mean, I think there is an argument to be made by it. It's not to say that there's no such thing as pleasure without relief. I don't know, but let's just say that there's definitely a lot of pleasure. Does come down to relief, then I think that this is maybe the principle that much of this violent entertainment is based around, is that people they'll remember the relief of getting through the horror and the violence as pleasure. And so they're so, but basically, I mean, that's Hitchcock again. You create the suspense. And you work the audience up, and that probably at a basic physiological level, we don't enjoy actually the violence all the suspense, but because it resolves itself, you said this about how the cartoons or the kids' movies, it all turns out well in the end. There's this pseudo catharsis. It wouldn't be real catharsis because it's falsely generated anxiety. It's not really tapping into the innate anxiety to release it. It's actually putting it in us for, you know, illegitimately, and then providing the relief, a bit like how the drug trade works, really, isn't mm-hmm. it? Get you addicted, mm-hmm. and then you got mm-hmm. you hurt, and so we've just conflated that, you know, that the more stressful the viewing experience is, the greater the relief.
Well, I mean, it seems that there's something to that. I mean, I used to go to a hairdresser a long time ago that was just vicious, like, you know, shampooing my hair like with nails and, you know, whatever. And geez, I looked great when I left, but she's like, you know, I had to pay hell to get there, you know. And my mom said to me, like, why do you go to this woman? And I was like, I don't know, I'm so relieved when I can walk out, yeah. You know. But how much practice do we need to then be able to deal with the bear that we meet in the woods too? You know what I mean? Like, on the one hand, like, good practice for real life situations, but how many of those do you need? Mm. You know, how much can your little heart stand, really, you know? Especially because it is addictive, right? Mm. You know, you do find yourself needing greater levels of whatever it is, you know. And to imprint on a child's brain, to my mind, that's the real, right? Mm. Like, when you're older and you can, you know, you can eventually have the cathartic experience of, you know, being able to realize how something affected you and processed it and put it aside or whatever, you know. But when you're a kid, you know, the thing too that makes me worry, you know, is that so much of this feeds into militarism, right? Whether it's, you know, just cruelty against anyone, you know, or just that thinking that you know, bad things happen all the time and, you know, you better be ready with a punch or something, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, so it seems like it might have this effect also of keeping one in sort of a constant state of anxiety, even, right?
Yeah, attention and react, ready to react. You said earlier, the might makes right, and I remember this, the TV show Lost. It became funny once I became aware of it, that there was a gun on the island, and basically whoever got the gun became the leader, and they would just point the gun at anyone who disagreed with them, and it was like, that's the American way in miniature.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You never saw that show.
Yeah, well, and it occurs to me that, you know, most people, I don't know about most people, don't join the army. An awful lot do, but let's just say most people don't join the army. They don't own guns, and they don't point the gun when they want to get their own way. But that's just an extreme example of using force to try and win an argument or get what you want. And there'd be, you know, much subtler ways in which this kind of media and these narratives would instill us with that reactive energy, whereby as soon as we start to feel uncomfortable and as soon as we feel we're not getting our way, we need to, you know, armor up and get militaristic, you know? Mm-hmm. just by shouting the other person down or whatever it is. It could be in the smallest way, but microaggressions.
Well, and to see that we've all sort of been primed for that, right? Like, you know, probably since the inception of film. I mean, you know, it's that book Operation Hollywood. You know, it's just how the military's been, you know, part of the industry since its inception, but at least for the last 20 years, you know. Mm-hmm. And now look at where we are. I mean, it's and people are applauding it, you know, like to be, and I don't really feel like I have a horse in this race, right? Because you know, I feel like to some degree all of these people are complicit in something bigger than the party system, right? But to have a national leader saying things like, you know, no, go ahead and beat the hell out of anyone that saying anything against us, that has worked well historically.
Yeah, well, and that's on both sides, because that's the punch the Nazis.
Well, it is, what
the liberals are saying. So,
I don't know, sort of a Schrodinger's cat kind of a, you know, it's the most clever setup I've ever seen, you know, on what's happening politically now, you know, not least with the virus. We're in a real mess.
Well, you mentioned that you'd come to this through looking at the progressivization of education, and one thing that I think is significant about social justice warriors and this whole ideological identity politics madness that we're surrounded by now is that actual justice has become irrelevant. It's more about, you know, how horrible Donald Trump is or whatever it is that's pushing the people's buttons. People and people in general are not objecting to US foreign policy, for example. That used to be one of the main concerns of the left, and now it's all transgender or race or, you know, all this critical theory indoctrinated stuff. So it's interestingly in line with the, as you said, the normalization of military action and the celebration of it, even, that it's not really a cause for concern for most activists anymore.
There does seem to be, I don't know how to say it, like some sort of meta situation, right? Like, on the one hand, it seems very sophisticated to me to finally look at some things, you know, with race or sexuality or whatnot. But the bottom line politically to me is that, like, I feel like my piece is, you know, not particularly delve into politics. I feel like it's a both sides of the aisle kind of thing, right? Like, everybody's should be concerned about what problems their children are having, right? Or just children in society in general. But the fact that most of the people, no matter what side they're on in the government here, signed the Patriot Act, re-signed it, well, there you are, you know. So now, you know, you have a country that, you know, really just, you know, like just almost viciously against each other. It again, at a time when we all really need to be coming together, because the next thing that's going to happen is, you know, is the economic problem. So how many, you add in a good, I don't know, hurricane and volcano, and we have the whole, we have every script that, ever could have been written.
The disaster movie. The scripts all coming together, yeah. I was interested actually in, because you mentioned Shirley Temple, and we've been talking about violence and the indoctrination through violence and with violence, and I hinted at, sure, that's such a narrow bandwidth, and there are surely other ways to create entertainment that doesn't have violence. And of course, there are other forms of entertainment, and they're completely devoid of violence. But in my view, they're just as insidious and pernicious, such as rom-coms, romantic comedies would be an example. So I thought Shirley Temple might be a good thing to segue into, because pretty much violence-free kids' movies that seem to the naive eye to be so innocent and positive, and yet what's the subtext there is child abuse. Pedophilia, the sexualization of children. So actually, it's consistent, like the two streams there of indoctrination, the light and the dark, the seemingly light and the seemingly dark there, they seem to be quite consistent with one another.
Yeah, that's a really disturbing thing because, first of all, a lot of, pageant kids, like pageant kids, I mean, like 95% female, right? Watch those films to, to try to increase their cuteness. That's a whole weird, representing representation thing anyway, right? But
Are you saying they watch Shirley Temple films?
right, like now, like
Even
today in today's
today.
world, right?
Oh.
But the films were done, the government asked for Hollywood to help in the war effort, and they asked during the Depression to help cheer up the country, and Shirley really embodied that. So it wasn't just little kids going to see those films; it was, grown men who didn't have a job and were desperate and really needed that message that here's this little, I mean, like basically in every film practically, she's like the been orphaned in one way or another, and if Shirley can do it, then anybody can, kind of thing, which I'm sure was a message desperately needed and will be desperately needed again fairly soon, right? But and that's just sad, but so here's this little girl, her mother lied and said she was 3 when she was really 4, so that she would seem extra amazing. She was doing, I forget how many films a year, but like a grown actor would be like, yeah, there's no way, and then in between those, she was, she's like mostly worked to death, doing ads for the dolls of her and the clothes that are like hers and this, that, and the other thing, I mean, she was really worked hard and she barely got anything for it. Most of the money was spent by the time she was grown up. It was another one of those tragic situations. Where the parents maybe mishandled some things, whatever, but that little girl, first of all, on the set, if she misbehaved, she was put in a black icy box. Now, she had two, like it's like a box that had like a big block of ice.
Wow.
So she'd either sit on the block of ice and freeze or not, right? And she would get a really bad earache. She's like 3 or 4 years old or something, right? Like she's just a little kid. Now in her autobiography, she says that, that was a great learning experience for her
Oh my
because it was
God.
better to be out there acting, than freezing to death and getting an earache, which I don't know that I'd have such a chipper feeling about it. She was Flash, which by the way is an action that's often done before rapists turn into rapists. They will flash people. And Arthur Freed, I think it is, who did the song that I did previously love, Singing in the Rain. He apparently, when she was, a little kid, exposed himself to her, and she just, laughed and left the room and was lucky enough to get out. Just one of the few that was able to.
So Arthur Freed, the author of Singing in the Rain, exposed himself to Shirley Temple.
Yeah.
That's a great anecdote. It's a microcosm.
And then later, this is also interesting, when it came down to who was going to play the part of Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, he had a part in that decision, and they said that they didn't pick Shirley because her voice wasn't as strong as Judy Garland's. But it kind of makes you wonder if, if he was still mad about it or something, But so there's all kinds of creepy things in the movie, right? Like in Bright Eyes, she's on the good ship Lollipop, which is a plane, right? Back in the day, it used to be called plane ship. It's another one of the tragic stories, her dad, I guess, died in the war. And so she's hanging out with his best friend and his buddies, and at the airport, new military guys. And then they decide they're going to throw a big party, her birthday party, on the plane. And her mom, who works for this wealthy family as a housekeeper, who's kind of treated like crap, and they might even tell her to come back really soon or something, I don't know. But she's not treated well, and she's rushing to get to the birthday party, and she has the cake. And this actually was kind of a Hitchcockian thing, I thought. the filming itself. She's running across the street, and she has the birthday cake in her hands, and she gets hit by a car, and you see the cake with there's a little plane design on it, right? And the plane is crushed in half or whatever. But there was something about I watched it, there was a paper on it. The way that the people view this accident, from a bus or, I don't know, but something about the filming perspective very much reminded me of a Hitchcock thing in The Birds, but I digress. So the dad's best friend, has been told that, the mom has perished in this accident, but he doesn't want Shirley to know. And he ends up taking the plane up to tell her, your dad's in heaven now, your mom's going to be there too. It's horrible, sad scene. But anyway, but before that, he decides to go ahead and make her birthday a happy one, I guess. And she sings On the Good Ship Lollipop. While these grown men who were I want to say it was UCLA, the football team or something, as she's singing, they're touching these big, supposed to be desserts, right? To her face, and there's just something a little icky about it, right? But what was really icky was, before Shirley started, in the movies, there was a show called Baby Burlesque, and spelled with a K instead of a C-U-E. And they were trying to compete with the Little Rascals, but the Little Rascals were pretty much just kids, and this Baby Burlesque thing was, little kids pretending to be adult stars from, the regular films. And there's one called War Babies that is very disturbing, not just because the kids are wearing diapers with big pins, but then they have on alluring tops, right? It'll be sort of a Mae West come up and see me sometime kind of There's all kinds of innuendo. And this one episode in particular, this War Babies, really broke my heart because that is really the closest thing to child porn I ever want to see. You know, and here's this little girl who's 3 years old. Not to mention, you know, what they do with the boys. I really don't recommend watching it at all, but...
Is it the one with the little black African boys?
Yeah, and he's like up, like, I don't think he has a shirt on, maybe, but he's sort of like entertaining for the little white boys. But then there's this other where he's like, I don't remember if it's like a painting of a cow or something, and he's like, you know, suckling from the nipple or something, but it's, and then there's like this you know, white, presumably milk that like splashes all over, you know, but it's the positions, literal and otherwise, that we put our children in is highly problematic, to the point where if you weren't even thinking anything like that, you would, you know, like watching these pageant girls. I don't know if you've, and it's terrifying because it's like, you know, they posted online a lot of these places that do it, and you know, they look sort of like Dolly Parton or something, you know, that all this makeup. And I had a friend who had entered her daughter into a beauty pageant, and I was like, oh, are you sure you want to do that kind of thing? And she said, no, this one doesn't, you know, they don't even like it when the kids wear makeup and so forth, you know. But when she got there with her daughter, they were all like, you know, dolled up or something, right? I mean, now there's these companies that take photos of the children and, you know, like do a computerized version so that it's flawless, but they look like terrifying robot dolls, like, and mature way beyond their years, you know. And the sensibility of a child is very different than an adult, you know. Like Graham Greene, the writer, you know, got in trouble because he said, and I cannot remember the exact wording, but he's like basically back in the day, like pointing out Shirley's sexuality, right? Okay, yeah. We don't, like I said in my book, we don't need to slut shame a little kid that's just doing what the adults around her are telling them to do, right? But he has a point. The parents actually sued him. He sort of left the country to, I guess they retracted it, the little paper they had written. And,
yeah, he was being critical, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was disliking, saying why he disliked the Shirley Temple movies because they were sexualizing her. And I don't know how explicit he was either in terms of that this stuff seems geared to appeal to pedophiles. I know he didn't use the P word, but it was implicit. And that indicates, I mean, okay, Graham Greene was a perceptive man unusually, but still he wasn't, you know, that perceptive in terms of he would have only been pointing out something that other people must have observed and been aware of.
Well, and so right, of course it's not the child's fault, but to who are these people that are, you know, again, like you point out, right, this terrifying side of Hollywood that does abuse its children,
yeah, including, I mean, the overlap that I again map 60 maps between, you know, casting children in films that may sexualize them and all of that being a pretext and a context for luring children in order to sexually abuse them. So,
right, and then we look at the Epstein thing, right, with the modeling.
Yeah.
We're going to make you model.
So it seems likely logical that the fictional media that's being created around the children, that to the extent that child predators are using that as a pretext, that would mirror it to one degree or another, and even the more that it can openly mirror it, the better.
Mm-hmm.
convenience for one thing, because the situations you're creating on camera are that much more similar to the situations you want to create for yourself off camera. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're creating child porn as well, you know, that there could be two shoots or two films being made simultaneously. But also in terms of a delivery device, as in, mm-hmm. and people want to spread their own pathologies. They want to normalize them because that's a way to make it easier to practice them, but also to reconcile themselves to them. And it's also mostly unconscious anyway. I mean, you can't help but pass on your proclivities when you mm-hmm. create media. So it's quite a large spectrum in terms of the Shirley Temple material being, you know, consciously made as soft child porn versus mm-hmm. completely innocent people who didn't even realize, presumably there were people on the set. Although that War Babies movie, I mean, that's so striking. The nozzle actually seems sculpted to look like a penis, and there's just no way that couldn't have been consciously designed to subliminally signal what's going on, and mm-hmm. and not as a way to alert people, clearly. Mm-hmm. I mean, that wasn't the aim and that wasn't the result. Mm-hmm. It's a way to hide it in plain sight,
which so many of these things seem to be, right? I haven't you know, delved into the dark side on any intentional level, but I heard somebody say that sigil magic, and I don't really know what that is.
What is it?
Sigil magic.
Oh, sigil magic. That means, yeah, creating a sigil based on a geometrical form with names, demonic names and whatnot, as a way to invoke or evoke or conjure an entity, more or less. And then it's often combined with sex magic, like masturbation and things like that, although not always.
Well, this person said that for sigil magic, you had to somehow divulge what you were doing, tell others what you were doing. And it makes me wonder if, you know, at the risk of getting too esoteric or whatever, it makes me wonder if it is part ritual. Mm. In some of these cases anyway, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Or you know, or in some cases, I suppose, designed as a warning, but that's certainly not the case in, as you said, in that War Babies thing. But how much of it is intentional, I guess, is the question. And we won't know. Although, I found it really terrifying as I was reading your book that whether it was Leonard Cohen or it was Polanski or Hitchcock, you know, that they say what they mean.
Hmm.
Right? There's no hiding it or thinking that, you know, like there was a time before, if I'd read that quote about the only problem is we need to torture the women more, right? Like, I would have thought it was a joke.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's a joke, you know.
Well, it wasn't in his life. He did torture his actresses, as I point out. So, yeah, mm-hmm. but same. I thought it was a combination of a joke with a metaphor, with an expression of an aesthetic principle, roughly. All of which I was down with, you know, mm-hmm. the sort of dark black humor I enjoy, mm-hmm. the principle I understood, the aesthetic principle. I forget what the third one was anyway, but the point is I liked Hitchcock movies. Mm-hmm. I had my own proclivity to torturing women, which I wasn't okay with. I knew that was dark and destructive even at the time, but I didn't. It took this long to correlate that with Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. As in, this isn't just something that's at the dark end of the spectrum with torture porn. It's all the way over at the supposedly light end with the high art culture of Hitchcock mm-hmm. movies or Polanski. It's just that it's much more sophisticated. The packaging is much more sophisticated. Three, four.
it's how much is done under the guise of art. You know, I mean, I remember when I was an art student before I switched to philosophy years ago at New College in Sarasota, Florida. And I made a little turtle and a little flower, and the flower had like little holes in it. So that you could put like an incense stick, and then, you know, it would drip into the turtle's back, right? In my pottery class, you know. And my teacher yelled at me and said, you know, what are you doing? Like, you're talented. You should, you know, use your art to make a difference, you know, to send a message. And then I'm not going to say the name of my fellow student, particularly because he's still doing art now. But he said, you should do work like so-and-so. And so-and-so's big piece was, no, and it was structurally amazing, okay? He had done this, like, plexiglass outline of a pregnant woman. But inside, you know those Halloween costumes where you can see all the blood pumping and so forth? Mm-hmm. It was like that, and I was like, what the hell is he saying? Like, this is my message, this little turtle. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that is my statement to the world. What's that thing, right? Mm-hmm. But because it was so well constructed, right? And it was terribly sophisticated, but I was like, what's the message? Mm-hmm. You know? And I feel like that about some of these things, you know, whether it's film or academia or, you know, whatever it is, you know, some of these political topics, you know, I'm at a loss to understand. Like, it's just very easy for us to get sucked in, whether it is, or maybe, you know, not just when it's, you know, torturing women in porn that's accessible online or something, versus these great art films. If the message is the same, right? Like, it's almost like we're predisposed to something like that is, you know, it's considered filthy, but if you're adding some like real technical expertise to it, hmm. and there's some message that, you know, that hits your soul, then it's okay, you know. But often it just seems like it's the same message.
In a certain sense, one could almost say that the torture porn is less insidious because it's stripped down to the bare essential. It's obvious that the only reason to watch this is because you get turned on by women being tortured. So as in my case, I would become aware there's a problem here, even if it took me more than 30 years to really start resolving it. Still, I was aware even at the time. Whereas if you have it embedded in this powerfully persuasive, artistically sophisticated narrative, then a person, it's a delivery device, isn't it? A person can be completely unconscious that they're really being titillated by violence against women or children or what have you, because the story's carried them along. Mm-hmm. They can even think that it's benevolent, that it's moral, mm-hmm. And so on. I mean, in some cases it may be. I mean, I don't dismiss all art just because it's violent, you know, or shocking. Mm-hmm. But I do think that my own faculties were so severely co-opted very early on for discerning, you know, the difference between exploitative art, because I used to think it was trash and art. Trash is exploitative, art isn't. But now I'd say it's exploitative art, and maybe there's truly empathic art. But I don't know if I don't think it comes out of Hollywood.
No, certainly not enough of it anyway. I mean, and I think that, you know, it's these websites will, you know, will increase that. So I think you're among the few that was able to discern this is not healthy for me and this is not whatever, you know, you came to about that. I think I think more often than not, people are lured into greater amounts of, you know, of torture porn. Whether it's, you know, this other sexual nature or not, you know, except for that term used for, you know, regular films too. So I think you should give yourself credit for that. I think it's not easy to take oneself out of it. You know, especially as a younger person, right? Like, you know, your 20s, and, you know, or whenever you get out of the house and you, now you can't really leave the house, but, you know, back in the day, you know, where I went to trying to get their first jobs or their first, you know, where they were in a date or whatever it was, right? Like, I mean, of course you're going to try like a lot of different things and see what works for you, you know, that seems healthy. You know, it's just unfortunate that so much of it, I mean, you know, including music videos now, right, that are actually directed by porn directors. You know,
right.
And you see the credit card being, you know, scanned down the woman's, you know, ass crack, you know, or you know, more often than not, it's an S&M thing that's usually directed against women. You know. So good for you for, you know, I don't think most people, I mean, that's like one of the biggest industries here now, apparently, is, you know,
porn.
Yeah. You know, and all the accoutrement that goes with it, you know.
Did you hear about all the child porn that was found on the Pentagon computers?
Oh, God, no.
You didn't hear about that?
No.
I didn't make it to CNN. That was a few years ago. There's a massive data bank of child porn in the Pentagon.
Well, you know, the whole honeypot thing is a bit of an offensive term, but, you know,
yeah,
of using it for blackmail. Apparently that's gone on for some time. You know, I mean, it's just coming out now. It lives something in Maxwell, I guess, but...
Right, and well, that reminds me of what you said, Adorno said about how the one's work becomes one's entertainment. So if you're in the military, in the intelligence community, and you've got to create child porn or create honeypots for people to fall into that includes child prostitution, you end up sampling the wares.
Mm-hmm.
It's a moral hazard, you know?
Well, and, you know... apparently the soldiers, like, I mean, of course, then the question is, did they ask for it, or is this, you know, intentionally chosen for them? The soldiers, like, one of the number one, you know, films, like, on the bases, you know, where they're in the middle of engaging in war, is, like, hostile and these, like, horrible... you know, torture films, right? Like, or coming back and playing a video game, right? So that, boy, that's a direct, you know, and now they're even, apparently, they're using the real life mission video games to, you know, to try to treat PTSD. I don't know, in my mind, that's the last place I'd want to be, is back for the you know, whether or not I have MDMA, you know, that's special.
Yeah, as opposed to just going for a walk in nature.
Yeah, exactly, and yeah, you know, talking to people and trying to move past that tragic experience or something, you know. But so imagine you're out killing people, and then you come back for a good round of, you know, Halo.
It's like, it's reprogramming, isn't it? They've been traumatized, and now we can heal you with some MDMA or ayahuasca or whatever it is, but we'll reprogram you in the process so that you can go out and torture some more.
Yeah. What's really terrifying is, you know, not just that they're recruiting a lot of these people, you know, my dad was military, you know, who came back and, you know, got the Agent Orange, you know, from Vietnam, but Oh, but you know, they're recruiting these guys, you know, to be the new guards in schools, for instance, which is a bit terrifying. And you know, the suicide rate, like that we know of, you know, is at least 22 people a day, veterans a day. You know. So I talked to a serviceman that said that, like, I guess normally they would have like one round, I don't know how long it was, in a war zone, and then they would be able to come back, you know, for a certain amount of time, and they've like just been running these guys like, you know, around the clock and not getting, making them do like two tours of, you know, in a row and stuff, you know, which is, it's just messed up, like. So I feel for those guys, you know, as much as I am like a total anti-war person, you know, talk about what's in effect on the spike even. I mean, and now, you know, the relationship between entertainment too is that, you know, they're getting rid of a lot of the recruitment centers and just putting in like gaming, you know, console, like huge halls, you know, where they have competitions, you know, they have contests to see who's good at it, and then going, what are your plans after high school? You know, try to get more people.
Well, I was thinking, I was hoping we could wind up on a light note, but I don't think we're gonna
Oh,
get to any
sorry.
lighter notes. No, I don't
That's a see if I
apologize.
can put that into the mall.
I don't think we're, I don't usually try and do that. I was just, it's just a thought that popped into my head. I mean, these are very dark waters, but. I'm not averse to them, as you know. I'm quite
Well, and I
warm.
love that about you. I love that you're willing to really, really look at it, and the work is magnificent. I mean, there is one hopeful thing, right? Is that we're still in a situation where we can discuss things, and I think it's very hard to kill the human spirit. You know, I mean, certainly they've come up with, you know, a million ways, and we're working on more.
Yeah, well, that is one way of looking at it, isn't it? That there's still a spark in all this darkness, and even maybe getting brighter for some of us. That's been the benefits of mapping hell for me, I think, is it's really helped me to discover what is not hell.
It really is a masterpiece, and I was deeply moved by it, and I really appreciate you writing it because I felt like I was, you know, just bleeding along with you, you know, in parts of it, and then, you know, but also how well you worked out of it and how you did point out the positive things, you know. But I don't really do that at all in my book, you know. I mean, my dad's way of making up for, you know, the person that he accidentally killed in the service was, you know, to volunteer later for. He was a member of the Disabled American Veterans, you know, helping the guys get their paperwork in, you know, the right way so that they could get benefits, you know. And just, he was really a person who, he really probably should have been a monk instead of joining the military, you know, but
Your father.
yeah. But, you know, he found ways to help other people, you know. He'd been a nurse, as a policeman, then he was a nurse in the military. But after he got out, you know, he put his 20 years in, and he, you know, there are ways to make things better, right? Or as much as you can, whether it's, you know, for yourself or others. And I think the important part is just trying, you know. I found your perspective very helpful, not only because you were trying, but because, you know, it's impossible to stop all the bad in the world, you know. But I always look at it like we can't fix what we don't know about. And to me, there's like a, I don't want to say citizen, but like really like a human obligation, you know. I always think like first, you know, do no harm kind of thing, you know, like if you can at least identify it and start the dialogue about it, you know. And every time somebody does that and points out the positive, that helps somebody else who's doing it, you know. So I'm grateful for your work.
Thank you. It's good to hear, and that there was that it was more than just intellectually stimulating is certainly my goal, because I don't think intellectual stimulation or information necessarily helps unless it does lead to some sort of movement, internal movement. So yeah, that's been my goal with writing, and to resolve something individually. And
well, and also I think it's very brave to address the personal. You know, I appreciate your honesty on that, of things that, you know, that you got hooked into and why, and, you know, I mean, I don't think that I'll ever get out of me the sort of that ideal of Hollywood and wanting to be involved in that, right? It's actually a lovely idea, really. I mean,
I mean, it would be if
it would be
if there was a real wizard, yeah.
But we're not the ones that, like, we were tricked, right?
Yeah.
By that pretend world that has that, you know, this horrible undertale, whatever, it sucks you in, you know. I mean, but the idea of it, right, of
creative community.
Exactly. That's a lovely thing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and it's the counterfeit of something real. I mean, there's no counterfeit without something that's being counterfeited, and it is possible to find that, and we are having a conversation now that's part of a creative community.
Well, and indeed, I was thinking when I was reading your book and your longing for the being a director and so forth, and the thrill that it is, and I've met some famous people too, and it's exciting in some ways, but I like that you acknowledge, like, having that didn't work out or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But I thought to myself, well, you know, why is it when something doesn't work out, right? It's because we're supposed to be doing something else.
Yeah.
So what you have ended up doing is just so much better than that would have been anyway, right? To take the work that's already there and explore it, and the people involved, and look at the, you know, the negative side of it, if you will, or whatever, you know, and why we're still attracted to some of those negative aspects, you know, even, you know, that's a really important exploration. So.
Yes, well, likewise.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, it was a living hell of 3 years.
What, writing the book?
Writing the book.
Was it? Do you want, how do you want people to read it? Do you want them to?
Yeah, thanks for that. So the easiest way is to go to Director Jordan Brown's website. He did a film called Steer Into the Lights, My Pretties, about how new tech is affecting us, which is really good. So it's HTTPS.
I can link to it.
Then his website, he kindly let me put the free PDF up there.
Oh, okay. So you
didn't have to buy anything.
That was my question. If you wanted people to buy it, are you happy that they read the PDF? Yeah, I can just link directly to the PDF.
Yeah, that would be great. I was going to move out of the country, and when I decided that, I took down my my Facebook page and my website, and I also took it off Amazon. Although I took it off Amazon just because I don't care for Amazon, I guess is the polite way to put it.
I didn't know you could take a book off Amazon like that.
Well, it seems like there may have been something in the fine print. I actually bought all the copies, but when I took it down, yeah. You know, then like I was charging like $15 or $20, and I took it down and started selling, you know, people were putting it on there for high right. prices. It's really yeah. annoyed me, and even though I didn't really have any money, I like went ahead and bought all those, because that just, except for one, there was one that was like $100 or something, and I couldn't afford it. But all the others I bought, you know, that just defended me. It seems like there may have been something in the fine print that they, like, maybe could still advertise it, but the way that I had done it was print on demand,
yeah,
you know, so that if somebody ordered one, they would print it, you know. But I think it says, for the most part, I think it says, like, it's just unavailable. But what annoyed me was they wouldn't let me advertise it for the Kindle. Mm-hmm. And they said, due to its controversial nature.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And well, I'm not happy with them anyway, you know. I mean, how much money do people need, you know? And I don't know. I have a problem with their business ethic, you know.
Sure. Like
not protecting workers and so forth. But yeah, so they wrote me a letter saying that I couldn't pay to advertise it for KDP.
You couldn't advertise it, or you couldn't publish it, or both?
I could publish it. Yeah. I just, and they would, and then if somebody ordered one, they would print it, and then they would take their share out, you know, and send me
the Kindle. Like
$3.16 or something for a book.
Yeah.
And but I didn't have the money up front, though, to like print a million copies, you know, and send them out myself. So that was a good option, you know, to get it out there. And, you know, sadly, everybody looks on Amazon. But when it came time, like, I wanted to pay to advertise it. So that, I guess, like, on the Kindle, like, when you get on the regular pages and you look up a book, it's, and it says, like, people who bought this were also interested in this or whatever. I guess it was like a thing like that going along the bottom. And they said that I couldn't advertise it, you know, even paying for it, because of its controversial nature. Yeah. And I said, well, what specifically?
Yeah.
And they said, we'll get back to you in a couple of days. And then a couple of days, like a week or something went by, and they wrote me back and they said, we have to consult with a number of teams.
Yeah.
And then I guess they consulted with those teams, and then their final answer back to me like a month later was saying that the Kindle is a personal device, and that they didn't want to like startle anyone when they were like in their bed or, you know, in the toilet or however they put it. I don't know.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Because they also don't like advertising, bodily function books like menstruation or breathing, which I found very interesting because my material is very life and death. And I guess that's...
Well, it's not as though they read it, though, is it? It's not like they read it. They would have got the title and then maybe they read the blurb. So presumably it's because you're saying that media is monstrous and they don't like those two words being...
together.
Street. Ah, ah, ah.